Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 167 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So before we get started this week, I think we have, didn't we have a guest, Sum?
I mean, it's hard to tell. You tell me.
I don't know. Is there a third person there giggling in the background? Yeah, I thought so.
I just want to sit here and listen to you two talk for an hour.
What? No, not going to happen.
That's what she's used to. That's what she's used to, because until tonight, I didn't realize we haven't had her on the show yet.
Okay. Yes.
I know, me either. And the funny thing is, before Summer said that's what she's used to, I thought Summer was going to say that's what I'm used to. And I was going to say that. Touché, bitch.
That is equally true. In fact, oh, one, it was either last week or a couple of weeks ago, you actually said to me, you didn't talk a lot tonight. And I was like, I didn't have anything to say.
She normally comes in and says like either something, you know, sarcastic or rude or clever or something, but she always has something to say about something. And last week or Sunday, whatever, it was just like, I mean, what she did say was fine, but it was like...
Thank you for qualifying what I did say as being fine.
What you did say wasn't bad. It's just that you said it like one thing.
You know what? I looked at my spikes in my speech pattern, and it looked like I talked a whole lot more than you think I did.
Oh, no. I've been editing it. I looked through the whole thing. You didn't say hardly anything.
Well,
it's mostly me. I mean, it's usually mostly me, but it's...
Exactly.
So we're 2 minutes in. Should I introduce myself now?
Sorry, yes. Okay, I don't even think we got your name in there. Who is this? Who is this stranger?
This is Candida. I don't need a last name, do I? Everybody knows who Candida
no.
is.
No.
You know, you're like Cher, Candida. You don't need a last name. But we do need to know a little bit more about you, Candida. What makes you qualified?
What makes you... Well, let's see.
To join the Outlander podcast.
I've read the books more than once.
That's a start.
But I can't say it's been like 10 times like some people. I have only read chapter 11 in the today for today's podcast. I meant to read it from the beginning, but I was lucky to read chapter 11 for today.
Welcome to my world.
Summer, you are part of a podcast. You don't need any other reason than that. Candida is not. She was invited on to see if there's any chapters she was interested in joining us for. She picked the chapters, and that was totally, absolutely her choice. But she can only pick the chapter. She does not know our schedule, and she cannot divine when she needs to be ready. And so someone named Ginger, I don't know who that may be.
It's not me, clearly.
Texted her this morning. What time was it? Like 10 o'clock?
Morning. Later.
Shut up.
Actually, it was almost lunchtime for me.
Yeah, we have a little bit of a time difference, but around her lunchtime, which it makes it even worse, actually, I said, hi, I was looking at the schedule and I saw that you're on chapter 11. We're recording tonight. We'll be glad to have you. I'll send you a link. Okay, bye. And she was like, okay.
I actually prefer it that way. I think it'll be more fun just winging it, you know?
Oh, gosh, don't tell me that.
I'm not over-prepared. That's how
I go every week. So you're in good company. But I understand you do more than just read the books.
No, that's what she does every day, all day. That's all she does is read the books.
She has more involvement.
I was too busy to read Voyager because I was reading written in my own heart's blood again. No, I'm kidding.
There you go.
Yes, huge fan of the show, as you know. And I do have a little blog called Not Very Originally. Candida's musings, nothing fancy like Candida's Outlander musings or anything like that. And I suppose I'm most well known for Jamie's Top 30, which is just a very silly, silly blog that I put out celebrating Sam Heughan's acting ability. But and I'm way, way behind on second season. I promise I'm going to get the last four episodes out before season three airs next year.
Now, how do you find Jamie's top 30 from episode 207 when he's hardly in there?
Well, that one was a little tougher, and I haven't published it yet, but I didn't quite get top 30 looks. But sometimes it could be surprising. I start going through it. I mean, obviously, I go through and I grab, like, sometimes anywhere from 100, you know, 200 to 350 screen grabs. And I start going through them thinking, oh my God, I'm barely going to be able to find 10. And then before I know it, I've got 50 and I'm like, oh my God, now I have to narrow it down to 30, you know, because he's got such amazing little, you know, inflections on his face and the little expressions that he makes. And sometimes I think I actually do manage to catch some expressions that some people maybe miss or just kind of gloss over as they're watching it. Maybe it's because they're looking at his chest or something like that. I don't know. Although we didn't get as much chestage this season as we did first season. But
chestage. There's there's a lot of things we didn't get a lot of this season.
Yes, I know. And I tried my best not to complain about it because I don't want to sound like I'm this sex fiend. But I'm like, hey, where's the romance? Where's the intimacy? It's just, it was, you know, they focused on so much of the politics, which is fine. I thought it was great. I thought that was a great part of the storyline, but I really was sad not to have some of that intimacy in there that we had in the first season, and I hope it comes back in season 3.
Oh, it has to. Print shop, people. Print shop. So, okay, but real quick, when you're putting a blog together and you come up with, you decide you're going to do a list, mm-hmm. how do you decide 30? Where does 30 come from?
You know, that's a really good number. The whole blog started out is because one of my Twitter followers was having a rough time. And I won't mention her name, but she was very down and we were kind of tweeting about it a little bit, although I don't usually get too personal on Twitter, but it was her, not me. And I decided to I wanted to cheer her up. So I put together this list and it probably started out as 30 because maybe I had 50 and I'm like, I can't do that many. And 30 was as low as I could go. And I put together the list and I published it. And I said in the blog that it was for her, so I guess it's not a secret. If anybody goes back to my very first one, they'll see that I kind of dedicated it to her. And I said, I hope this cheers you up. And I thought, as I lay in bed, oh my God, that was such a little silly thing that I did, and no one's really going to care. And then I woke up the next morning, and my email was going crazy with everybody, posting comments because they all loved it. And I was so surprised. I thought, oh my God, I couldn't believe it. And that's really how I got started. But then once I had the 30, I kind of stuck there. Some weeks have been a little harder, and I've had to squeeze some out. And I've been tempted a few times to lower it to 10 or 20, something that might be a little easier. Because it's time-consuming, just as your podcasts are time-consuming. My blog is nowhere near as time-consuming as your podcast. I mean, to put together and everything and produce. But now that I've got that 30 number, I feel like I'm cheating if I go lower. I've had to a couple times because if Jamie's not there, then I can do about it. I hope that answers your question.
Works for me. To our read-along. This week, we are discussing Chapter 11, entitled, oh God, Torremolino's Gambit.
Something like that.
And this is before Ginger dives in, I should say. Because once she starts, I won't have a chance. but before she starts, I'm always tickled. And I always think to myself when we have friends of the show come on and choose chapters, what makes them choose certain chapters? And usually there's something scintillating or, you know.
No, if it's Mandy, there's just sex.
Right. She doesn't mean to, though. She doesn't mean to, though.
No, but she always does.
She doesn't without meaning. Why did I choose this one? You close your eyes and then, like, in the phone book and you just put your finger in and like, oh, there's a sex scene.
Exactly.
Exactly.
But in listening, I listened to the audiobook today on my drive home. In re-listening to this chapter, I was like, what on God's green earth made Candida choose this chapter?
Are you that serious question? You really don't know?
I mean, is it the homoerotic tension? I mean, or is it the chess?
I don't consider it homoerotic tension, but I will say, as I reread the chapter today, I did forget about Jamie's dream, so that was a nice little surprise. This is one of my favorite scenes because, as everybody knows, Lord John Grey, with the exception of Jamie and Claire, is my absolute favorite character. I love him to death. And I am so looking forward to those scenes in season 3. And this, of course, is the first time that Lord John Grey makes his feelings known to Jamie by making a pass at him and Jamie's threat to him to kill him. I love it. It's so powerful. I cannot wait to see it on the small screen.
Oh, Lord. You need a bigger TV, my friend.
Well, you know what I mean.
I hear what you're saying, and I get it. Mm-hmm. And I am so mm-hmm. ready, and so I know he looks. I mean, he does not look black. He's very good looking, and I can see with full lips, and you know, he's got some sharp features. He's not our Lord John, David Barry, is not exactly effeminate looking, but he is a beautiful man. As he's not rugged, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? He's got beautiful features, mm-hmm. so he is feminine potentially mm-hmm. in that way.
I wouldn't say feminine. He's pretty, but he's not feminine.
Okay, then that's what I mean. He's pretty, but he's not. He's a beautiful man. He is not. He's not as chiseled, if you will. I don't even know if you saw that. Or maybe he is chiseled, but he's not rugged like Jamie. You know what I mean? He's not rugged like...
But I don't need him that way. You know, and as a matter of fact, for years, I pictured someone like mm-hmm. Tom Hiddleston in the role, who is not effeminate. I mean, he can absolutely. Go...
I mean, you can't look... You're not looking at me right now, but I'm like, how can you look at me with that face and tell me that Loki is not moderately effeminate?
No, that's what I'm saying. As an actor, he can play effeminate, but he can also, I mean, did you see The Night Manager? Okay. He was not effeminate in that at all, as far as I'm concerned. Okay. I mean, he's got range. I think he can do it, you know. I think he would have been a nice, I'm sure David Barry is going to be wonderful, and I'm not going to, you know, be disappointed with his performance, so.
No, and when you said that was part of the reason, or that was the reason that you chose this chapter, I immediately thought of David Barry, and I cannot wait. I am seeing more and more of him in Summer. I don't know how far you are, but I just finished season 1 of A Place to Call Home. I just started season 2. I think I'm like 2 or 3 episodes into it. And dude's got like, I mean, talk about inner struggle and inner turmoil. His Lord John role is like, he's been playing Lord John.
I ask you a question?
Uh-huh.
Because I'm only on episode 3 of A Place to Call Home.
Of season 1?
Yes. But that being said, after episode 1, my brain was telling me that this dude has been typecast. Am I wrong? You're much further in.
Typecast, like that's all he plays?
Typecast is in, I have a feeling that what happened in episode 1 had to do with a forbidden relationship that did not.
Oh, you don't know this already?
Fruition. I'm only in episode 3.
I thought it was made known by episode. I forget what episode that it was made known in, but I don't want to spoil that for you. All I'm saying is, or anyone else listening.
It's too late. All I want to know is he been typecast? But is the event in episode 1 something akin to what happens in this chapter?
No, because he's not rebuffed.
No. That's not what I mean. Not akin to that. I'm just saying, was the reason that the thing in episode 1 happened because of maybe a Hector-esque perhaps situation. That's what my gut told me.
Back to Summer's question. It's not just the hand on the hand that made me pick this chapter, but I also like the conversation they have where Jamie reveals that he knows who Lord John Grey was. You know, that whole time Lord John Grey was hoping he wouldn't remember him as that kid who made a fool of himself. So I love that part about it. And, I mean, it's a short chapter, but there's a lot in there, really.
It's a short chapter, but it took me longer to take notes on this one than it did last week. Last week was 19 pages and this was 9.
It's a short chapter, but it still took Davina half an hour to read it to me.
Okay. Well, let's get started with the chapter that Summer loves to pronounce. Lisa T writes, just as the last chapter ended with Jamie and Lord John bonding over a humorous moment, this chapter opens with them cementing their friendship. So Team Ardsmuir returned to their regularly scheduled programming. Quote, a brief period of formal negotiation over the affairs of the prisoners, followed by informal conversation and sometimes a game of chess. Unquote. On this particular evening, they were discussing Samuel Richardson's novel, Pamela. So they discuss the size of a book and whether or not it is justified, the size, by the complexity of the story. And I say, time out, ladies. We could have the same discussion about the Outlander novel.
Yeah. Yeah. As I was reading that, I was like, Jamie's talking about his own story, how Diana is telling it. It's so funny. I'm like, was she smiling as she wrote this?
And I wonder if Diana is having fun with her readers here.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
From this conversation, we hear it must be expensive for the publisher and an effort to the reader to have such a lengthy novel. A novelist's skill lies in the artful selection of detail, and perhaps something that is really long reflects an author's lack of such a skill. And in the end, though, Jamie admits that while that may be true in this novel, Pamela, other such longer stories, they require greater space in which to be told, which is also, I think, fair. Now, Jamie, of course, likes big books and he cannot lie. I mean, being in a cave for 7 years would convert me to big books if I weren't already into them.
I was going to say, you've already been into big books. Though most of your big books just live on a shelf and you never read them.
Now, have either of you ever read Pamela?
No.
Meant to look up the Wikipedia synopsis or something. And
if you would have come out with that, I would have been like the most impressed I've ever been with any guest. I just read the Cliff's Notes.
We don't
have the kind of time. Eileen P. writes, I love this question posed by Lord John. Quote, do you think that the size of the book is justified by the complexity of the story? Unquote. I wonder if herself had to justify the size of her novels, which are as long as needed. I love that this discussion is used to develop the relationship between Lord John and Jamie. It's nice to see some happiness in Ardsmuir. Meanwhile, Lord John is smoking a cheroot or cheroot. I never knew it.
I'm pretty sure that Davina was like, cheroot.
He's smoking a something, and he's blowing smoke rings. Now, did anyone else get, especially since our father played him, this was somewhat reminiscent to me of the caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland. And so after that, I kept that was in my brain. I was looking for symbolism the rest of the chapter. And I'll tell you what I found later on, or what I think I may have found. I could be stretching it. But we'll see. So then Gray relates a story of a friend of his mother's. How she saw a book of large size and said, oh, Countess, you are so courageous to attack a novel of such stupendous size. I fear I should never dare to start so lengthy a book myself. To which his mother replied, don't worry about it for a moment, my dear. You wouldn't understand it anyway. Love it. That sounds like something Diana would say,
too. She says it all the time. No.
Exactly.
That's how she does her weeding.
That is true. That is true. And so, I wrote, this is so much DG to her readers. Lisa T. writes, I've often wondered if this is herself giving a nod to the size of her books. I love when Jamie and Lord John have literary discussions, and I love the little glimpse we get of Lord John's mother. So they play chess, and Jamie is by far the more skilled. But he was always trying new things. This evening, and this is Lord John, this evening he tried Tortomolino's Gambit, quote, a risky opening, a queen's knight opening, unquote. It wasn't a trick used against a fair player. It was to be used against someone who knew how to detect the knight's threat or its possibilities. Now John awaits Jamie's move. Jamie touches the knight, and John exhales loudly, and Jamie glances up at him. But it's too late. Gray had triumphed, and Jamie was tricked. And he acknowledges it. Quote, why, you cunning wee bastard? Unquote. John has learned it from his elder brother. He says he should have expected something like that from Lord Melton. And John stiffens immediately. He wonders if Jamie has known all along who he was, just as he had known from the first who Jamie was. Jamie says that he'd met Lord Melton on Culloden Field. John says he knew. All of his pleasure at having beaten him has dissolved. Jamie says he has the meeting with Hal to thank for his life, and thus was not likely to forget it. Jamie says he wasn't so thankful when he met Hal at Culloden, however. He'd refused to shoot him. He thought he had a reason to be shot. He really didn't see going on much. And this surprises John, who says that he would have thought that from the things he'd said about Charles Stewart and his cause, he wouldn't be too aggrieved for their loss. Jamie acknowledges, quote, "There were some who fought for love of Charles Stewart, or from loyalty to his father's right of kingship. But you're right, I was not one of them," unquote.
Now, when Jamie met Hal, were they taking names? I mean, Hal knew Jamie's name?
Yes. Yeah, it was in the farmhouse at Leanach Farmhouse, and all of the people who I don't know if the Scots, like the people who couldn't, the Scots took their comrades who couldn't walk and everything. I don't know if the Scots took the Scots into Leanach Farmhouse. I'm guessing so. And they were there for like, what, 2 days before the British came up? Or if the British took, or the English, whatever, took people from the field into the farmhouse. Mm-hmm. I think the Scots took the Scots. Am I right? Huh?
I'm not sure.
Okay. So on Culloden Field, go forward a little bit. The people who were in Leanach Farmhouse were all Scots, or they fought on that side. Mm-hmm. Who took them all? If they could not walk, who took them to Leanach? They did not fall in Leanach. They fell on the field. Like, Jamie couldn't walk.
Right.
Didn't they all kind of like drag each other and stumble?
That's what I said. The Scots brought the Scots.
I guess I thought,
just the way you phrased it.
Well, there's no other
weird
way to say it. Sorry. But that's why I was fighting with how to say it too. Okay. So the Scots brought each other there rather than the English bringing them there. The English just eventually found everybody and they were, yes. So Hal's secretary or whomever was making the list of the people before they were out, taken out and shot.
Yes.
But one of the things that I do find, am I allowed to talk about storylines that are outside of this chapter from the Lord John books?
I mean, we can't speak to them because I haven't read all of them, but I'm okay with you bringing them up.
Oh, okay. Well, I think one of the other reasons I really like this chapter is there's a lot of history in here, we know about with John if you read his books, that is not included in the main Outlander series, and it's information that even Jamie never really learns. And I'm just going to say it, you know, that Lord John Grey was raped at Culloden. So it's something that he and Jamie have in common, but they never share that they never admit it to each other, although obviously John probably suspects something because of Jamie's reaction. I think that's something that goes through my mind as I'm whenever I read this chapter, and that whenever they're talking about Culloden, and you know that they have a lot, they have that in, well, Jamie wasn't raped at Culloden, but and then of course they both lost their greatest loves there, which has nothing to do with the section we just read.
But it is in this chapter. They talk about how they kind of bond a little bit more over the fact that they both have lost someone during the time of Culloden.
Right.
Gray says he felt much the same. He lost a, quote, particular friend, unquote, at Culloden. He finds himself having difficulty of speaking of Hector to Jamie, who may have been the one, for all intents and purposes, to have slain Hector. But he finds himself with a type of kindred spirit. Quote, "He could not help but speak. There was no one to whom he could speak of Hector, save this man, this prisoner who could speak to no one else, whose words could do him no damage," unquote. Hal had made John go look at Hector's body. He said that he had to, because unless he saw him, he would grieve forever. Whereas if he saw and knew, he would grieve, but then he could heal and forget.
Did anyone else think about Faith during that? That totally made me think about Faith.
I did not, but one of the commenters did. Yeah.
Well, that makes me think about, actually not about Faith, but about Claire, because at this point, Jamie's thinking he's never going to see Claire again. So
exactly. That's what I thought of too.
The rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this just reminded me of Claire's discussion about Faith when she said they made her see the baby.
Oh yeah, of course.
Right. Because and that is something I've heard from not just this book, but in life with my friends who've, you know, lost children, that, you know, everyone says that they have to see the baby, because or else they'll always wonder. So I mean it's overall, it's not just with regards to babies and whatever, it's everything.
So his brother had said that if he could see the body, he would grieve, but then he could heal and he could forget. But John thinks or says he may heal, but he would never forget. Now, John asks Jamie honestly, do you find your life greatly burdensome, Mr. Fraser? Oh, but
I guess I'm going to interrupt there for a second. I mean, okay. Perhaps Hal is saying that Hector will forget, or that John will forget because he doesn't know. He thinks Hector's just his friend and not something more.
That's a possibility because, yeah, I mean, are his proclivities, I hate to use that word, but are his proclivities known at that point? And when he's 16?
They have to be. They have to
when
be.
He's 16?
He would not have made him look at his friend to
and
grieve.
I thought about
you don't
that
grieve
too.
Your friends like that.
But I don't know. Would John really be that comfortable telling Jamie this story when, you know, this is something that he could be put to death for?
It feels like he's laying groundwork.
Except remember one of the quotes I just read, that John felt very safe telling this to him because his word could not be used against him in any way.
Right, but at the same time, I had actually written down that question, how, you know, John ends up making this pass at him later, but I don't know. That seems pretty dangerous to me. How does he know, you know, Jamie won't file
groundwork, people, like
some
I said.
Kind of complaint, you know?
Yeah.
Who is he going to complain to? They're in the middle of nowhere.
All it takes is, I mean, look at this day and age. All it takes is an accusation, right? And it's the same thing back then. So anyway, go ahead.
True. I just think that honestly, this almost feels like he feels safe with him. He knows he can't, there's nothing he can do that will ever egregiously injure him in with regard to his status. But also, as he's becoming more and more enamored of him, this is also kind of perhaps laying the groundwork. Like, maybe, hey, this is who I am.
Maybe he doesn't think so much that it's Jamie can't, but that Jamie won't.
Perhaps.
Or maybe neither. Maybe that he might because he's lonely. Ultimately. Maybe not that night.
That's how a lot of stuff goes down in prison, people.
Maybe
even if he doesn't respond positively that night, you know, hopefully he wouldn't like reject him like he ended up doing. But.
Well, but I, you know, I don't think anyone believes that Jamie sent him mixed.
No. That's not what I'm saying. But I think because he's there for who knows how long, potentially the rest of his life, mm-hmm. and because he's literally trapped, compared to the other prisoners, he's getting favors. I mean, he is kind of
and it is something common that the prisoners do with each other. Jamie talks about that with Claire later, that they're so lonely that they, you know, get their companionship wherever they can.
Right, but didn't they also talk about discreetly turning their back and pretending that they weren't taking care of themselves?
But I think they took care of themselves. I don't think they bare-backed each other.
Wow.
I thought there were some relationships.
You just fully went on bareback. I mean, that's something I would have said. I'm just saying. The fact that you were the first person in this episode to talk about barebacking somebody.
I know they did that because Jamie talked about, you know, with the chain and how he could never do it without everybody hearing him. But he was not, he was the only ones in chains. But
Jamie wasn't barebacking. Jamie was talking about handling himself.
No, I know. Jamie was going solo, but what I'm saying is...
Full disclosure, if he had chains, barebacking was not the issue.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm saying that I think there were probably relationships in there, and that doesn't mean that they were relationships that would continue if they left the prison. It was just they were there because they were... Yeah, you can go solo, but they still wanted that companionship. So I would be shocked if there wasn't something going on.
Full disclosure, have you seen Orange is the New Black or ever known anyone who's been in prison? Sadly, I am on both of those lists. And I know for a fact that stuff happens because people get lonely and they need companionship and touch and to be connected to someone other than themselves. So it's not, I mean, even though the act itself is sexual in nature, a lot of times it's not about the sex.
Oh, right,
it's just about needing to connect with somebody.
And that's why you said everybody just kind of turns around because they understand.
They get it. They're not all getting it, but they get it.
But of course, it's a little bit different with John Gray because it's like the boss with the employee, which is a big
It's not like it is. It's in today's age. today's day and age, today's area, today's place, whatever, it, at least in the U.S., it would be called sexual harassment because he's in a superior position.
And I guess, was there no such thing as sexual harassment in the 18th century?
I mean, I don't know.
There were no laws against it. I mean, clearly it existed. It existed,
but I mean, nobody
but it wasn't
was
known
patrolling
as anything wrong.
Exactly.
No. And to be honest, I just went through sexual harassment training at my work and I learned a lot, as in how to sexually harass people. And that I, you know, I'm clearly not doing it effectively enough right now.
How to and how not to sexually harass people.
Exactly. And then the biggest portion to remember is that the thing that makes it harassment is that it's unwanted.
That's true.
As long as it's wanted or it's not rebuffed, it's not harassment.
So, and that goes back to John Gray making this pass at Jamie. So, and I said, we know that Jamie didn't send him any mixed signals, so he's testing the waters. But at the same time, he knows he's the one who's in the position of power.
Yeah.
But even though this is his point, you know, the first scene and this last scene in the chapter are his points of view, you never once hear him in his head have any kind of inkling that this might be wrong. He just feels like he's falling in love. I'm going for it.
Well, and that's part of what I love about Lord John Grey is that they don't talk about it a lot, but he's a romantic. He, on many levels.
In the wild prison where he's stuck, he's a romantic.
I know. Well, I know that sounds weird. I know everyone, there was no sound when I said that pin drop. But
no, I don't disagree.
He was just
but I wouldn't calculate.
Driven, I know.
Crickets.
I know, but he is, because he's driven, it was an emotion and it was a connection and it wasn't like, I want to put my boner inside of you.
Yeah, it was like you said about people taking,
it's, he's
people in prison or in jail, whatever, is what they do. They're just looking out for companionship. Lord John is freaking alone as heck, just as much as the prisoners are. He just has better conditions.
He does, but come on. It's more with Lord John. He's a bigger character.
Well, you said he is a romantic, and he is. He doesn't just go for the one-night stand. He's looking for the long-term relationship, and, you know, Jamie's in for the long term, so...
Oh, but thank you. Summer, you just got done saying the same thing about the prisoners, though, that it's not just about the boning, it's about the relationship to have another person there. Now, Lord John, it may be more personal in that, yes, he's lonely. Yes, he wants the touch and the feel of cotton. You know,
Screw you. Okay, Aaron Neville. Okay.
There's companionship. There's companionship and attraction. The men themselves are experiencing companionship. There might be some attraction as well, but John is different because he's attracted to men. So
that part's different, but if you excuse it for just a second, it's similar to the people in the prison in that they're alone and they're looking for companionship. However, it's sadder or slash worse for Lord John because that is his leaning. That is his sexuality. And so it is like seeing like a serving wench, you know, who comes in and feeds you once a day. That's your attraction. That's your natural attraction. And so you're alone. You don't have anyone, and you want that touch, but you are physically and romantically attached or attracted to that person.
Okay,
you know, and if you think about it, you know, I was saying that he never once thinks about that what he's doing might be wrong, but John's in a unique position because he's you know, the commander of the prison. So everyone is beneath him, including the men that are working for him. Really, the only one who's equal to him and at his level is Jamie, even though he's a prisoner. You know, he's kind of the leader of the prisoners and just the sort of the whole bit intelligence and Jamie wonderfulness. So he's really the only choice.
All right. This is how I'm differentiating between Stockholm Syndrome prisoners who just want to get some jollies off and feel something, and Lord John. Lord John isn't trying to get his jollies off. He's trying to connect, like have an actual connection with Jamie. It's not, he didn't reach over and grab his junk. He didn't watch him bend over and try to like touch his butthole. He reached over and touched his hand.
But Summer, you're now making it sexual when you just got done saying earlier that in prison there may be sex involved, but it's about feeling and connection. So what I'm trying to say is
No, not feeling. I will say it's about connection, but the connection is a lot of times.
Yes, but it's about a human connection, and there happens to be sex involved. I'm not saying they're falling in love, but it is that connection, the intimacy of actually having a human connection with someone. What I'm trying to say is it's not identical, but I'm saying I'm likening it to that, to the prisoners, to the people in there. However, it's worse for him because that is his orientation, and he is attracted, and he does have feelings. So it's worse, is what I'm saying. It's harder.
Is it harder?
Not going there.
How hard is it? Anyway, I mean, we're all basically saying the same thing now.
Being there is more difficult than what you're saying.
Thank you. That's all I'm trying to say. I still say he's a romantic at heart. He is.
We're all agreed that it's not about sex for John. It's about he's in love.
John asks him gently, "Do you find your life greatly burdensome, Mr. Fraser?" And Jamie says, quote, "Perhaps not greatly so. I think perhaps the greatest burden lies in caring for those we cannot help," unquote. John responds, "Not in having no one for whom to care," unquote. And Jamie replies, "That is emptiness, but no great burden." And Jamie finally opens up a little bit more about Claire. He tells John her name and acknowledges that she was a healer. And then John asks, "You cared for her very much, I think?" And Jamie says, "I had meant to thank you sometime, Major, for that night at Carrie Eric where we first met, for what you did for my wife." John's voice is hoarse as he replies, "You remembered." Now, Jamie says that he was a worthy foe, and John says, "If you think a 16-year-old shitting himself with fear is a worthy foe, no wonder the Highland Army was defeated." I loved it. To which Jamie replies, quote, "A man that doesn't shit himself with a pistol held to his head, Major, has either no bowels or no brains." Unquote.
Now, does Jamie really think he was an honorable foe? I don't know, what was the word that he used? Worthy foe. And then, you know, later Gray saying he's looking at him and knows he's not making fun of him.
Yeah.
But, he's kind of... I almost used a euphemism that I knew Summer would take around and twist, but he's buttering him up a little bit there, don't you think?
Is that like buttering him up, like lubing him up?
Yes. Yeah.
Jamie's buttering him up?
There, I think.
Why would Jamie be buttering him up? John should be doing the buttering right now. There was no butter present. Jamie says that, not knowing Claire was actually in no danger, John had thought to save her life and virtue at the risk of his own. And they have a quiet moment. And just before he takes his leave, Jamie tells him, "Your brother was right, Major." So Jamie, who hadn't had the opportunity to see Claire's body, to know she wasn't dead, but safe, he prayed, in another time and place, couldn't forget. He carried that loss with him always. Lisa T. writes, "As they bond over their lost loved ones, we learn more about Lord John. Ironically, Jamie can't share much about Claire with anyone because she's a time traveler, and Lord John can't share much about Hector because being a homosexual was not acceptable at that time. Now, somehow, they each respect each other's privacy and empathize with each other."
Oh, and I guess this just goes back to my little non-segue earlier, was that they have so much in common and they don't even know it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Only the audience knows. That's what's so fun.
I know. Deborah C. writes, "While playing chess, Jamie and Lord John discussed their first encounter and losses at Culloden and how tough it is to get over the loss of a loved one. Hal made Lord John look at Hector's body. Quote, unless I knew Hector, my friend was really gone. I would grieve forever. If I saw and I knew, I would grieve, but then I should heal and forget," unquote. Jamie thanked Lord John for standing up for Claire's honor. Jamie also says Hal was right about grief. This helps explain why Jamie and Claire cannot get over their grief at losing one another. There has been no closure. They haven't actually seen the other has died, although Claire knows Jamie is long dead by the 20th century.
Well, from a straight timeline. I mean, but we know that's why she goes on this whole search for the list of the dead so that she can know for sure.
Well, wait now. She knew for sure. Well, she was convinced he was already gone. She wasn't looking for him. She was looking for everyone else.
Oh, that's true. You're right. Like
you know, in the book. In the book, at least.
Like, she was liar.
At the beginning, yeah.
Right. She assumed that he died as well. But still grieving, wasn't she? That's true. Seeing it, I don't know. Maybe there was a little bit of she didn't want to.
But see knowing and knowing are two different things.
And making it real, even though he was real. Yes.
But whether right. she knew that by 19, he was definitely 70, well, 60, whatever. That his body
if
was
nothing
in the ground.
Else, that's the comfort that comes from time passage. Is that the fact that regardless of how and or when. He died. He was clearly dead by 1960.
And not mostly dead, like in The Princess Bride.
Or in Monty Python's Holy Grail.
Oh, Bring Out Your Dead.
Oh, they say mostly dead too?
Yeah.
Yeah, Bring Out Your Dead.
Oh, Bring Out Your Dead. Yeah, okay.
Him on the head.
I'm not dead yet.
Yeah, they kill him.
Clunk. Didn't they hit him over the head?
I feel happy.
Oh. Joe B. writes, a friendship has developed, trust established, shown in Jamie's use of informal language, quote, cunning wee bastard, unquote, after a loss at chess. Comfort allows Jamie to bring up the past, how Lord Melton saved his life after Culloden, and he thanks Lord John for what he did for Claire. John does the same, sharing that after Hector's death, his brother Hal made him come and see the body. Jamie probably remembers what Mother Hildegard did for Claire after losing Faith. Quote, so I didn't imagine, I remembered, unquote. In contrast is Jamie, who never saw Faith. And how awful is that? And doesn't really know what has happened to Claire. He must imagine. He tells John that Hal was right to make him face his grief.
So this has absolutely nothing to do with anything, but this is for Summer. Summer, did you know that Alexander Hamilton? Of course you did. Alexander Hamilton was born the year this chapter is taking place.
Say that one more time because I didn't hear all
Hamilton
of it.
Alexander Hamilton was born on January 11 of the year this chapter is taking place.
55?
Fascinating.
Yes, there you go.
Somewhere in the Caribbean, a young Alexander Hamilton was being procreated.
A bastard orphan.
And I'm not
going to
sing it. You're welcome.
You should, though. You should.
There's my little bit of trivia.
Jamie likens his weekly visits for talk and chess with John to his time in the cave and the trips to the house. Here, though, it was reversed. Quote, going from the crowded, cold squalor of the cells up to the major's glowing suite, able for a few hours to stretch both mind and body, to relax in warmth and conversation and the abundance of food, unquote.
Brings up the question, when Jamie comes into Gray's office, is he stinky? He has to
be. Probably.
That's a good point. He probably doesn't. And he doesn't get to bathe either, so, huh?
Himself and getting ready for their hot date every night, and she comes in filthy and stinky.
He gives himself a horse bath and heads to John and Grace.
He stops in the horse
chambers.
Trough and washes himself off. I mean, I'm just sitting there. Are they sitting there playing chess the whole time and John is holding his breath? You know, I'm just wondering.
Stinky chess. It's stinky chess.
I mean, we know. I mean, he's not stanky Claire who loves to smell Jamie's armpits.
It's musky chess.
Musky Jamie.
Oh, gosh.
It's extra horsey musky, chess. Though, in
chess.
Right? Well, here's the thing, though. Because he's... And I don't know how tightly packed in they are with one another. But he probably doesn't... It's probably not even him that smells. It's probably him smelling of everyone else that he's sharing
he
that room
in
with.
He talks about how it smells pungent as a fart. How can he even smell them?
Seriously.
First of all, it should be used. He's got to smell he's like, oh, that's not them. That's me.
Right. But he's been away for like an hour. So he went to a clean smelling area and then he walked back into the fart.
Diana writes, it gave him the same odd sense of dislocation, though. That sense of losing some valuable part of himself that could not survive the passage back to daily life. Each time, the passage became more difficult. Unquote. Now, this actually sounds like our Claire and her passage through the stones. The men are mostly asleep as he returns to the cells. It's late, and Murdo tells him he'll be tired in the morning. Ronnie Sinclair asks him if he was fed well, and Jamie says yes. And then Ronnie asks him if he'll tell them about it the next day. When Jamie, the loner, was coming to the house after a month or so in the cave, he got updates from his family. Now, as Jamie returns to the cells, it is reversed, another reversal. He provides the other men in captivity a taste of the somewhat outside world beyond their cell walls.
I want to know why Stinky Jamie's not sticking some biscuits in his pocket.
You mean not taking something back with him?
Yeah, why is he not sneaking some food?
That would they're not
he's
feeding him
all.
That much. I mean, they're not giving him baskets of biscuits. It's not a buffet. They're bringing him a plate
of food.
It should
be, though.
Like one plate, and he's finishing everything.
He needs to put it in his chipmunk cheeks.
Even the crappy food, he's eating it and saying, well, Voltaire wouldn't have eaten this, but I did.
Now, here's Candida's second favorite part. That night, he dreamed of Claire, heavy with child. She brings his mouth to her breast, and he suckles, and she's nourishing him. Again, an image of Claire as Madonna, as mother figure. Now, he woke up surrounded by the men in the cells, and he's just hoping that he hadn't cried out.
Oh, you skipped over the best parts.
Oh, gosh, tell me.
No, I'm kidding. You just skipped right to the end. I thought you were going to read the whole thing.
I wasn't reading it. These are my notes.
Oh, okay. I've got the book open in front of me, so.
tell us, Dara. Now that you brought it out, you got to say it.
No, it's a very nice scene. I'm sad.
You already told us that part.
I'm sad that he woke up because I wanted it to keep going myself. and of course, it reminds me of the opening to The Scottish Prisoner. So,
okay, I have not read that book, but this reminded me of.
Stop
it!
Right now,
I own it. I haven't done it yet. I own it, but I haven't done it yet. This reminded me of the blue-tinted pregnancy sex scene in season 2.
Oh, yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, I tell you, I gave my sister The Scottish Prisoner for Christmas a few years ago, and she started reading it, and she called me when she was a couple pages in and said, that's quite an opening, because it just starts right off. So maybe you'll call me when you get to the same part. But yeah, that's what it reminded me of a little bit.
I will.
And what you said too, that scene. I love how she adds that Claire back into the story there. That we don't really get that so much in her scenes, do we?
Mm-mm.
We've talked about this though. Doesn't Jamie have remarkably prophetic dreams? Kind of.
He has more sex dreams than her. That's for sure.
Well, not only sex dreams, but dreams like people have talked about them being perhaps traveling dreams, where he dreams of being in other places.
June 18th, 1755, the same year a bastard orphan is born. Not a bastard orphan. She's kind of a bastard orphan.
Can I ask, do you guys know what is the date when this first starts? We're jumping to June 18th, so the beginning of this chapter, do we know what the date is? Like, how much time has passed?
Last chapter, there were a lot of dates. This chapter, this is the first date. But last chapter was like March, April.
Okay, so are we thinking that this is the very next chess game and evening that they have together after the last one, or
well, the chapter starts with the chess game.
Right, I know, but
the chapter starts the chess game, and this is a different one.
Yes, I know that. Do you have an idea how much? Do we have an idea how much time has passed? Is this just like two days later?
Oh well, it's once a week.
Once a week. Right. So this is probably but doesn't mean it's the next week. I mean, it could be a month.
No, that's true. Right? It may not be the next week. That's correct.
To build up his nerve to make a pass.
Especially, you're right. Especially since we get a date now.
Like,
we didn't get a date before.
For real, though, I can't imagine him being 1 week. Let me tell you about my lover that died at Culloden.
Exactly.
And then 1 week later being like, can I touch your hand?
Because like I already admitted, guilty, I didn't read the beginning of the book when I sat down. I mean, since I haven't read it in like 2 years. So I was just trying to get a sense of how much time has passed.
Well, I think it's telling. Not only does it make sense or not make sense that he would go from talking about Pamela to making a pass in 1 week, mm-hmm. right? That, I think, is a logical conclusion to make. But also because, again, she did not give us a date in the beginning. But if we go off the previous chapter, you're in the March-April time period. And then suddenly in the middle of a chapter, she gives us a June date. And you're like, holy heck, that's like months.
Okay.
So there's a reason she only gave us one date. I think it's to like kind of shift us and jolt us that it's been time passing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But yeah, I don't think it was the next week. June 18th, 1755. It's another chess night. Diana tells us how John had gone all out this night. Dressed carefully, fresh linen and silk stockings. He wore his own hair, of course, rather than a wig. And it was rinsed with lemon verbena. And he he wore Hector's ring.
For real, though.
And he has
for real, though. I don't do that much work for a hand-holding ever.
Summer.
No.
I think he was hoping for a little bit more.
I'm just saying.
You don't think
if hand-holding is the only thing on the menu, I'm not going to do that much work.
Sounds to me
he was going for all of it. And dinner was a pheasant that he'd shot himself. So he was part of every detail here.
That's right.
Yeah.
He was dressed to impress and shooting to impress.
Lisa T. writes, the detail of him wearing Hector's ring reminds me of two things. One, that Jamie wore his father's ring when he married Claire to look as best he could. And two, that Claire continued to wear Frank's ring, even though she was married to Jamie. Just as Frank will always be a part of Claire, so Hector will always be a part of Lord John. Another similar thing.
Yeah, but Hector doesn't really... I mean,
isn't part of the story.
No,
really
Hector's dead. Let's move on.
You know, once you meet Jamie, Hector who?
Hector who? Who the what? Who the
huh? Story of my life. Hector who?
John goes to get sherry for them, and sweat is running down his ribs from, quote, from sheer nervousness.
Because he wants to touch his hand. Oh my God.
Or
he's so cute.
Lisa T says of this next part, okay, so I get a bit distracted imagining this next bit myself. Okay, Lisa T, we're all in this together. So, they were deep into a game of chess. Jamie was in thought. John gets up and stretches. And hold on, let's stop right there. You know when you get up and you stretch and walk around, you are either about to try something. You know, the whole when you're sitting next to somebody. Well, in movie theaters, I'm sorry, in TV and movies where a guy sits next to a girl, or vice versa, but usually it's a guy, who like yawns and like stretches so he can put his hand around. Yeah, he's about to cop a feel or make a move. Okay, so he's all stretching. Like, got it. That's a huge signal. He walks around to see the board from his opponent's perspective. Jamie had worn his hair back in a thin black cord. Quote, it would take no more than a slight tug to loosen it. Unquote.
Oh my God. Whoa. Poor Lord John. Sit down, John. Poor Lord John. He's like, he wore that for me.
No, I don't think he suffers any illusions about that. I just think he's like, it would take one tug.
I don't think I see it being a thick, glossy mass. I think wouldn't it be gross?
It would be gross, especially if he's not showering for him.
Horse baths do not include hair washing.
That's true.
This is just
horse baths
saying.
Are armpits and crotches. That's
he's
it.
He's seeing Jamie off being all clean and perfect. And
that's
he's nice.
True.
He's stinky, Jamie.
Someone is thinking of loosening Jamie's hair tie, and there's only one other person in the room. Okay. You can guess who it is. So here you go. Quote, John Gray could imagine running his hand up under that thick, glossy mass to touch the smooth, warm nape beneath, unquote.
I mean, I legitimately can't blame him.
It's a glossy mass because it's oily as F.
Ginger, you're nasty.
How am I nasty? You guys talking about horse bath and he's not showering. Because, I just tried to make the final conclusion.
You made it a little sexy and you made it dirty hippie.
Oh. At least there's no patchouli.
Oh, God, no patchouli. Don't do it.
Oh, Lord. It's now John's turn. He has a silent, one-sided conversation with Hector. Quote, is it wrong, Hector, that I should love a man who
it's
might...
It's totally wrong because Hector's dead.
That I should love a man who might have killed you, unquote? Or was it a way to heal the wounds for them both?
It's more wrong because this is a man who will never love you.
Wait, is John falling in love with Jamie a way for them? How does that heal Jamie's wounds?
It doesn't.
I think he thinks that if they get together, that they can help each other emotionally heal the wounds that were left by losing their loved ones.
They both have such complicated histories and they're both such complicated personalities. They are not ready for each other. They are not ready for this. Like I said, we, the audience, know more about each one of them, and they've just, like, scratched the surface of each other's lives. And so he's just jumping the gun. He just touched Jamie's hand a little too soon. That's all. That's the only problem.
Way too soon. As in too soon meaning while he's alive. While he's alive, it's too soon. But Ginger.
Yeah, but then it would be necro.
Ginger. For the record, you can't say, like, together and then not use the same accent with a further word that also has at the end. You need to continue the accent, my friend.
No, dude, that's how I make it stick out. It's funny that funnier that way. As he made his next move, he made his next move. Quote, without stopping, his hand rose as though it moved without his volition. The hand traveled the short distance through the air, looking as though it knew precisely what it wanted, and set itself on Fraser's, palm tingling, curved fingers gently imploring, unquote. I feel so sad for Lord John.
I love the way she describes Jamie's hand as Me being too. Motionless as marble, because you can just... see Jamie's face, you know, when they touches. And what?
Exactly. And this is what Candide is referring to. And further, quote, the hand under his was warm, so warm, but hard and motionless as marble.
Can you say that a little more sexy?
I tried to make it less sexy.
You should be like, because, I mean, if you just, seriously, but it was like warm.
So which is kind warm, of an interesting
analogy
because his hand is warm.
I'm like, come on. It's beautiful. I don't want to use your NPR voice. I don't want it because I don't want to make fun of it. This is a very sad time for Lord John. I don't want to make it coopy of it.
Coopy.
Okay.
Coopy.
This is a great, the whole paragraph is great. It's three sentences long and I love it. Fantastic.
Nothing moved on the table but the shimmer of the flame in the heart of the sherry. He lifted his eyes then to meet Fraser's, unquote. Jamie reacts. Take your hand off me, Fraser said very, very softly, or I will kill you, unquote. John felt, quote, the shiver of revulsion, a spasm of hatred and disgust that rose from the man's core, radiating through his flesh, unquote. And needless to say, he moved his hand away.
For real, right?
Quote, there was a moment's silence, broken only by the rain's patter and the hissing of the peat fire, when neither of them seemed to breathe. Then Fraser rose without a sound and left the room, unquote. Rain falls angry on the tin roof as we lie awake in my bed.
Stop, Edwin McCain, stop.
So, in another situation, if this weren't prisoner with the warden, what do you think Jamie's reaction would have been? Do you think it would have been the same? You think he would have been cool and calm and controlled, or would he have fought the guy?
I legitimately think that if there was not a hierarchy involved, there would have been somebody dead at the end of that.
You actually would have killed him and not just beaten him to a bloody pulp.
There would have been at least dire injuries, if not death, because you have to understand he was so traumatized.
Well, I know that.
We all know.
Would he have been seeing Blackjack's face as he was doing it?
I'm sure he was. He saw it in his dreams when he was murdering somebody in his dreams.
Oh, but does he do that in the book as well? I thought it was just the show.
It's definitely in the show, but it's been a little while since we read Dragonfly, so it could just be in my brain.
These books are a lot. Just like Pamela's a lot. Thinking of my Alice in Wonderland thoughts earlier, the only connection I'd make is perhaps that, well, a few connections, but the first one, as far as the color of the blue caterpillar, we don't have a lot of blue or any blue in here, I don't think, except for Jamie's eyes, but John is gray. But not blue. So I don't know if that's close enough or not. Maybe not at all. And also, he is living in a mystical fairyland, thinking that Jamie would return his feelings. Maybe he's eaten his own mushrooms. Jamie has a way already of dealing with it, growing larger and shrinking, perhaps not, but returning to civilization for a short while and then going back into the cells. In both cases, here at Ardsmuir and at Lallybroch and the cave, he did undergo a sort of metamorphosis. Diana wrote that it was like Jamie becoming more animal, less human, as he walked back to the cave. Remember, in this chapter, she wrote about that change. Quote, it gave him the same odd sense of dislocation, though, that sense of losing some valuable part of himself that could not survive the passage back to daily life each time the passage became more difficult, unquote. So maybe there is a bit of an Alice in Wonderland quality here. Because at least in Aarsmuir, that change, that shift of him going back, not going to John, but leaving John and going back to the cells, did involve a meal.
So was he the animal when he was in the cell?
A meal when?
He eats with Lord John every time they meet and play chess. They have a meal. And then he has to return to the cell.
Oh, you're trying to say it's an eat me, drink me thing?
I'm saying that there is the difference of the two worlds. There's when she's, obviously there's her real world, but then the caterpillar tries to help Alice out by telling her, you can eat this or drink this and change your size, change yourself to fit in more in that world. Now, John's not doing the exact thing, not at all, but there is food and drink involved, and there is a change or a metamorphosis involved in both places.
Well, my question is coming from what you said about what Diana had written about how is he, you know, more, he's living as an animal sort of in that cave, and then he goes and he has to be a human when he's with the family, and here he's the animal with the men, and he has to be human, and he's just refined. I mean, he's drinking sherry, for God's sake, and he's playing chess. You know, he's human again.
Mm-hmm. Well, here, Diana does not seem to make, I mean, she may be alluding, she's definitely alluding to it, but she doesn't seem to make the same comparison as animal / human or less human or anything like that. But the comparison she does make to the cave versus from the going to the cave into Lallybroch is that there is a change in him. There was as she wrote, dislocation of thought, that he was losing a valuable part of himself, as of course happened when he became animal, right? Or became more animal. And each time he went, it became more difficult. And that was true going back and forth from the cave to Lallybroch. And here she's saying it, specifically going from the cell to John and back.
That would be hard. That's like going from coach to first class. You know, you get sent back. That sucks.
We need to talk to Mandy about that because I don't even know. I don't even know what you're talking about.
Who does that? Even Mandy. Business class. Business class is a whole other world.
It is. It is. You don't want to go back once you're up there.
No, I'm coach, which means I'm like, you know,
you're in the
cattle
cell.
Car. I'm with all the other cattle in the back.
Joe B. writes, Lord John makes extra special preparation for Jamie's weekly visit. And the moment I expected to happen since I learned of Lord John's sexual orientation is here. And it's car crash-like. We know it will not end well, and the risk Lord John is taking is huge. At best, it's discharge from the army, at worst, imprisonment and possible execution if Jamie reports him. The move is made over chess and is quietly but definitely rejected. So much is said in this encounter, and much of it is physical, in contrast to the verbal exchanges of the last chapters. Their erstwhile friendship is probably why Jamie doesn't make an official complaint. However, such a strong reaction from Jamie, he's been propositioned before, and I don't think it's reaction to homosexuality as a concept. It's a response to a massive betrayal of friendship, the memory of Jack Randall and Wentworth. Here in Aarsmuir, he is using the power he chose to give up at Wentworth in rejecting Lord John. And this time he is able to reject the overtures of an officer of the crown.
Well, certainly Jamie wouldn't have had the same reaction without his experience, but would John have made a pass at him if he knew of Jamie's experience?
Oh, yeah. Probably not. Probably not. Lisa T. writes, this is such a heartbreaking moment for both men. Lord John, because he really loves Jamie. Who doesn't? And for Jamie, because it brings back memories of what BJR did to him. So what had become a comfortable friendship is now irrevocably changed. And finally, Martina P. writes, very surprised that Lord John let down his guard and let the emotions get the better of him. Whatever possessed him to make this move on Jamie? How could he have not anticipated this reaction? Certainly, Jamie cannot harm his reputation in any way. However, surely he does have great respect for Jamie and is almost intimidated by him. So his behavior came as a total shock to me. And I presume Martina P. means when she read it, obviously, for the first time.
Oh, well, certainly, I mean, we already answered that. I mean, Jamie wasn't sending him any signals, but there was a definite camaraderie there that he thought he could springboard. Yeah. Woohoo! onto something.
You're my friend.
Note to anyone who's not sure 100% that the person they're interested in likes the person that they are. Maybe you need to do a little bit more research.
Yes.
Ask a few more questions.
Yeah, like Summer and I mean, we have banter and we both have blonde hair and wear black glasses at certain videos. And that sounded really bad with what I'm about to say.
Where are you going with this?
We are not look-alike lovers.
We are not.
Oh, sorry. That followed really badly with talking about video.
For real. Let's not talk about the videos we've posted.
I had, what was the episode where, I don't, I'm so embarrassed to ask this. What was the episode that had Lord John Grey in it?
Oh, wasn't that like 13? No, sorry. Like 11?
11. Okay. Let's just say it was 11. Somebody will tweet and go, it was 10 or whatever. So I remembered one of the Jamie's top 30. I had the way he was looking at Lord John Grey, and I made the joke that probably 99% of people didn't get that. Don't worry, they kiss and make up.
You're mean. You're evil, but it's funny.
Well, dear listeners, that was chapter 11. Please join us next week when we discuss. Chapter 12, entitled Sacrifice. Thank you, Diana Gabaldon, for giving me something I can pronounce.
Pretty much everything in this book.
I couldn't pronounce the last one.
Except you had a hard time with the last one, and I would have probably had a hard time with that too, because, yeah. So thank you, Candida, for being with us. And if I'm not mistaken, I was looking at the calendar. You'll be back with us in a few weeks.
Chapter 14.
Bring it. Chapter 14.
More sex scenes.
Oh, Lord. You're going to take him away from Mandy. Mandy will be happy that you're doing that for her.
Yeah, she'll forgive me.
Thank you, as always, so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod or email us at OutlanderPod@gmail.com.